Hi, I'm Sam Cedar.
And I'm Emma Vigeland. This week on Ring of Fire, I speak with Matthew Clare, an assistant professor of sociology at Stanford University. He is the author of Privilege and Punishment, How Race and Class Matter in Criminal Court. I ask him about his piece about public defenders in the nation, what the history of public defenders are, and what their role is in today's current criminal justice system.
And of course, we will run down the biggest stories of the week with Heather Digby Parton. If you're listening to the free podcast right now, do us a favor, support the program. You can help us out by becoming a member over at rofpodcast.com. Now here to break down this week's news, Heather Digby Parton from Salon and the popular blog Hullabaloo. So, Heather, there are a couple of big stories. I mean, the obviously the ongoing story is the tremendous explosion of COVID infections and deaths in this country. On Thursday, on Wednesday, December 16th, we're recording this on Thursday. We had 245,000 infections, 33,611 deaths, and 113,000 people hospitalized. And I went back, and my understanding has been to measure deaths relative to infections today, you take the infections today, you multiply it between 1.4% and 1.8%, and that gives you a range, and you look out 16 to 21 days. 240, I mean, to have 3,600 deaths, and, you know, we don't know if they happened exactly today or maybe they were recorded a little bit later. If you go back 2 weeks, 16 days, 21 days, that you're on the high end of the rate. In other words, it's closer to 1.8% death rate than 1.4%. And I can't help but think that might be a function of some hospitals reaching capacity. Maybe they're not necessarily advertising it, but they're having to make decisions about who they can care for in these and who gets the most immediate care. When this is what the whole flatten the curve was about. And so we have this situation with 245,000 deaths on December 16th. I mean, we could be looking on January 1st for over 4,000 deaths a day. And this week it was revealed, there was a story in the Times about how the CDC was essentially just, you know, sort of strangled in terms of its function as a scientific, health agency. And that there was amongst top Health and Human Services political appointees a specific agenda to create herd immunity, a secret one from the country. And this stuff is, I don't know if it's criminal, but it feels like it should be. I mean, literally criminal.
I agree with you. It's hard for me to see how this isn't criminal, or at least in some way civilly liable in some way, that there has to be some form of accountability for that. I mean, number one, it was secret, right? They swore up and down. I'm talking about the herd immunity thing. They swore up and down that they did. They were not, in any way officially endorsing that as their strategy. We've now found out that, of course, it was, and we knew it because Trump kept saying it, right? I mean, you know how he is. He just sort of, he can't help but sort of say the quiet part out loud, as the saying goes. And so he said this more than once. You know, we call it herd, he said at one point, which was a tip off. That was a very strange way of putting it, right? We call it herd, he said, in an interview that he gave. And then we see this stuff coming from this guy. His name is Alexander, and he was a part-time professor at some college up in Canada. really, you know, not in any way a qualified person to be setting any kind of you know,
public policy,
official public policy of any kind, much less a scientific policy like this. And he was hired by Michael Caputo, who is a right-wing operative. Nothing more. He was hired into the HHS and, you know, sort of installed there to run this sort of public relations side of the pandemic. And clearly, I mean, he's just a right-wing operative. He's nothing more than that. He had no expertise in anything like this. And obviously, their position was that they wanted to play down the pandemic, just as Trump had told Bob Woodward he was doing, and also to, you know, put out this idea that they didn't want to do anything about the pandemic, that they had decided that the best way to deal with it was to open up the country and let it run its course. And Trump said over and over, you know, it's going to go away. It will just go away. And, you know, we call it herd. And this guy Alexander used that same phrase. You know, it's called herd. And it's a weird way of putting it, because most people say herd immunity, right? But this guy said it in those exact words. And I remember picking that up. I wrote about it at the time, about Trump using that odd phrase. I'm going, what is that? At one point he said herd mentality, but that was a mistake. But he said this in a very specific way, which leads me to believe that he was aware of this guy, this
right.
particular guy, and using this particular guy's phrasing. And they had thought it through. And we had heard earlier about Jared Kushner saying, hey, you know, we don't want to bail out the blue states, let the blue state governors take the blame for the pandemic and all of this. And there was early on a report in the Washington Post that had Donald Trump at a meeting of the coronavirus task force in which he said, why don't we let this just wash over the country? And Fauci is quoted in there, and he was, you know, he was confused. It was such a bizarre thing to say. And he says, well, you know, what are you talking about? Just let everybody get it, is what Trump said. And Fauci said, well, we can't do that because, you know, there will be massive deaths. And at that point, Trump kind of went, apparently, oh, okay. And I think that was at the point in the spring when Trump sort of decided that he'd give it a couple of weeks. It was before Easter when he said he wanted to open up the pews. And he, for a little while there, he acted for a couple of weeks like he actually cared.
Right.
And I think that came out of that meeting, but it never left Trump's mind. That this herd immunity was his ticket. This is what they decided to do. So I guess my point is, this was an unofficial policy of the Trump administration, obviously. And they had people pushing it in various ways throughout the administration. They had these political appointees at the CDC. He brought in Scott Atlas, and he was also a herd immunity guy. They had political hacks stationed at Health and Human Services doing PR on this and, you know, trying to push this through. You had people like Ivanka actually editing press releases for the CDC, according to that New York Times article. So this was an unofficial policy, and that is, I mean, how can we let that go? I mean, I just don't think that this is something. I mean, there's a lot of stuff about the Trump administration, the corruption from, you know, top to bottom, all the obstruction of justice and the Russia investigation. I mean, there are a gazillion things you can look at. This one has to be done after the Biden administration takes over, one way or the other, whether it's the Congress or whether it's a commission or whether it's the Department of Justice or something. Somebody has got to do something here because, I mean, this is massive numbers of deaths, and it appears now the evidence is emerging that they did this on purpose. They did this consciously, knowing what they were doing. And that is, I mean, I don't know. We've had some pretty bad crimes in our history.
Right.
You know, genocide of the Indians, slavery, and all that. But, you know, I'm going to say this is up there. This is up there with the worst thing any president has ever done. And we can't let it slide. I mean, we just can't. Now, I know he's going to be out there screaming that the election was stolen and he's got this whole cult behind him that's not going anywhere right now. But, you know, this has got to stop. And I don't know if the revelation of this would be enough to make anybody think. I mean, it doesn't appear that it would affect his followers in any
no,
way.
But no.
This has got to be documented some way. And it's got to be there, you know, as, I mean, if we, you know, it's, this is 9/11 level, right? I mean, where they have to just go in and basically document the whole thing and get people under oath and start talking to them. And, you know, and if there are if there is any hope of criminal or even civil liability for it, they have to do it. I mean, am I wrong? I mean, this.
No, I mean,
I was shocked by this. I was shocked.
I think that, I mean, first off, I don't know what kind of, you know, I don't know what kind of liability is associated with this.
Yeah, I don't either.
But I mean, I'll tell you the sort of the low hanging fruit in terms of why you would justify this is so that when we get COVID 2025 or yeah. when it's whatever it is, that this is never, ever, ever, ever attempted again, and that any indication that it's being attempted. But it is, I mean, you know, I sound like a broken record, but I mean, like, this is, you want to talk about a failure of governance under a conservative administration. I mean, this is... You do this so that it never happens again. You do this so that people, educate some small percentage of the voting population, or the population at large, that there's a fundamental difference between people who believe in government and people who don't. This approach is a fundamentalist approach, right? And, you know, Donald Trump, I think, was just like, for him, it's just like, oh, it's the easiest one.
Right.
It's the one. And you know, I mean, one of the things about fundamentalism, and I'm quite convinced, when I say this fundamentalism, I'm talking about religious fundamentalism, is, you know, like the idea that herd immunity, we know it is a fact that there has never been a successful response to an epidemic or a pandemic that involves natural herd immunity. You achieve this through vaccination if yep. you can, but you don't just do, because, I mean, look, we can just look at the numbers. I mean, there have been 17 million cases reported in this country. Let's just, for the heck of it, double that number, right? Let's just say there's 35 million people who have been infected. In fact, let's do it times four. Let's say there's 75 million people who have been infected, right? That gets you, I don't know, let's say maybe 20-25% of the American population. Well, anywhere you need to get for herd immunity has got to be like 60%. So you're talking about the deaths of another, I don't know, 400,000-500,000 people minimum. To get to that herd immunity, if you're lucky to get it at 60%, and B, you can say, like, okay, you know, we're not going to bust through 60%. Like, we're going to land on 60%. Like, it's you're talking about the deaths of, you know, anywhere from 800,000 to, I don't know, 2 million people. And to achieve that, if that's even theoretically possible, because at one point people are going to be like, I don't want to catch this because I got too many people who are dying. Never mind the long-term impact of getting this, which we don't know. And so at the very least, you need to do this so that the idea of this is completely, made toxic. And this level of fundamentalism, you know, like I say, for Trump, I think it was an easy answer, but that's what fundamentalism is, right? Like, it is, you know, you wake up in the morning, if you're a religious fundamentalist, or I guess any other type of fundamentalist, you wake up in the morning and there's a lot of decisions you don't have to decide because your life is made a lot easier because, you know, there's certain foods you can't eat, there's certain clothes you can't wear, there's certain places you can't go to, there's certain social dynamics you don't have to deal with. Everybody knows their place because they've been told what it is. And if you're lucky, you're at the top of that heap. And so, you know, this is sheer insanity. And the Democrats really, really have to dig into this. I suspect that they might, as a way, in some ways, of like avoiding some of the other things, right, that The other types of corruption that, you know, maybe you're not want to, you don't want to push too much in that regard.
You may be right about that. And certainly there's going to be there are a lot of incentives for them to, you know, shove some of this under the, you know, put, sweep it under the rug for their own reasons, as you just implied, and also just because it's a very heavy lift, right? I mean, they would have to do a lot of work, and I think they're kind of hoping that the legal system, maybe in the state of New York, will take care of some of that and sort of expose him as the, you know, the corrupt operator that he is, and maybe the Department of Justice, there'll be some stuff sort of left over, some of these investigations that will somehow hit him, and they can maybe, you know, avoid having to get too far into it. Certainly, I don't think, you know, I don't get the sense that Biden wants to do that. And in fact, I get the sense that maybe they're thinking, because, you know, this week they decided, Jerry Nadler, and with Pelosi's approval, they've decided to pursue this McGahn subpoena into the new Congress, which is what the Republicans were hoping would not happen. And they're fighting this through the courts. I don't know if people remember this, but this is basically on a position of principle, which the White House for the first time said that anybody who worked in the White House and worked for the president had what they called absolute immunity, which meant they didn't have to respond to any subpoenas from the Congress. Now, it's sort of been wending its way through the courts. It got sent back. There were a number of things. And normally at the end of a Congress, a lot of things expire and you kind of have to say, well, we didn't get her done. But in this case, and they've done this many times in the past, they have made decisions to carry things over and they do it officially and there's plenty of precedent for it. They've decided to do that with this case, which on the issue of principle is hugely important, right? I mean, if the Congress can't subpoena anybody from the White House and they won't cooperate and won't come down and speak to them, you know, on an unofficial basis or anything, you know, I think then congressional oversight is pretty much neutered. There's no way to do it, you know, with any kind of a presidency. Now, if going through the courts, I think this is one thing that's smart. They're going to keep pursuing it through the courts. Now you've got conservative courts that will be dealing with that issue with a Democratic administration,
right,
which will test them on this, right? I mean, do they want Joe Biden to not be able to respond to Lindsey Graham's subpoenas? I mean, you know, who knows? But in any case, I guess my point is, I'm sorry for the digression, is that there are certain things they're going to be pursuing on the basis of principle. And those will sort of sweep in some of this stuff with Trump corruption. It'll be part of it in a way. But I think that you're absolutely right that this particular issue, which is just of such a, you know, I mean, this is 300,000 people are dead. You know,
yeah.
I mean, this is one way for them to get at that. And I think that it's an important way for them to get at it. And I'm not sure that the Congress is the best place to do it. I'm almost thinking that this is one of those situations where you need a big, high-powered commission with a lot of power to investigate and do all kinds of things. And I'm kind of hoping that Biden goes that way, or at least, the very least, some kind of joint committee where they have, you know, both houses of Congress working on it together, because it's really important. I mean, this is absolutely disgusting, and it kind of does, in its own way, say everything about what's happened over these past 4 years. I mean, it's got the corruption. There's all kinds of stuff in that, too, you know, with how many of these contracts were awarded to buddies, with Jared running his own little shadow of, you know, shadow task force, and all, there was a lot of stuff in this that kind of encapsulates the entire Trump administration, and it's
right.
The low point, obviously.
And so that is, you know, one, I guess, sort of half of our reality today. The other half of that reality is the stimulus fight that is ongoing. As of today, Thursday, they are now signaling that they may have to both extend the continuing resolution another week because they want to avoid a government shutdown. And they want to sign off on a $1.4 trillion basically operating budget for next year. And they are also still negotiating the COVID relief bill, which has has now been broken off, as people know, I think by now, into two essentially segments. One segment has the controversial, the most controversial provisions. One is Mitch McConnell's corporate liability shield, so that corporations are not liable for harming their workers or harming their customers in the event that they cut all sorts of corners in trying to sell their products. It also undermines work safety laws and like statutory responses by the government, not just a civil liability. It is a full-on liability. They cannot be held accountable for any health and safety violations, essentially. And that is coupled with $180 billion worth of city and state money to go to prevent programs from shutting down and firefighters from being fired. And let's be honest, it's mostly like teachers being fired is usually what they tend to do. And then the other one has on insurance extensions and expansion in terms of who it's covered, or I should say continuations of these programs. A lot of them are ending on December 26th, and about 12 to 13 million people are going to be without a job, but also without any unemployment benefits. And then on top of that, an extra $300 per week. There is also a $600 a one-time payment to people making less than $75,000 in the country. But that money is coming out of the extension on the unemployment insurance. It's not going to go 16 weeks. I think it's going to go closer to 8 weeks or 12 weeks. And there's PPP money in there, and there's some money for hospitals to do inoculations, et cetera, et cetera. So that's where we are. And the interesting thing is that came out just this week or late this week, Mitch McConnell is very worried about not passing something because it seems to be hurting Loeffler and Perdue in Georgia, and they have a runoff. They have a runoff election on January 5th, and so the Democrats seem to have some leverage. The question is, will they use it?
Well, you're right. And, before we get into the analysis, can I just ask you, whatever happened to is the eviction moratorium part of this, or does that come out of the CDC? I can't remember how
that works. The eviction moratorium would go for a month, and then presumably Joe Biden's administration could get the CDC to issue another one. And there's something like $25 billion in rental assistance, which I think most experts say is not totally sufficient, but will help in some regard. Mm-hmm. So that's the situation. I mean, that is, and we don't know what's going to be in the final bill exactly, but they seem to be, pushing around these numbers, and they are determined to keep a cap on the dollar figure at $908 billion, because apparently that's the magic number.
It's the same thing going back to 2008, remember, or 2009, when they were doing the stimulus after the financial crisis, is we got to keep it under $1 trillion. I mean, I just don't understand that. It's like, who are you trying to kid? What is the point of that? But apparently this means something to somebody. I don't even know who. But it is interesting what you say about McConnell, because I watching him over the past month or so, it's been very interesting to see how him navigate this. We don't really know where he was on the various negotiations up to this point. He kept very quiet about it. He indicated that he had a bunch of, right-wing fanatics in his caucus, that he couldn't bring them on board, and he didn't want to have it be a deal where it was majority Democrats who passed it, because that would be bad for Donald Trump, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, there was a lot of talk about that, and I've never really been able to sort of pin down. It'll be interesting to read, the real TikTok on this, if we can get it. Somebody will write it up about how all that went down. But now we're at this point where it seems that he really does want to get this through, and because he is a nihilistic, evil Grim Reaper, I think what he's saying is true. The only reason I could imagine him really wanting to do this, particularly now that the election is over, is because of Loeffler and Perdue. I believe that that really is his reasoning here, which is interesting, isn't it? Because, you know, apparently somebody in something that I read today, I can't remember, Politico, I think, talking about this, he's seeing ads in Georgia, yeah. And I don't know who's doing. I don't know if it's Warnock and Ossoff.
They're outside expenditure ads, as far as I know.
Well, that's interesting because somehow or another that's hitting. And, you know, however this comes down on this particular negotiation and this extension that they're looking for, I think that's telling about you know, going forward for Democrats. I mean, if that's actually something, you know, gee, who would have thought, right, that giving people material help in the middle of a crisis might be a winning message, but apparently McConnell thinks it is. And if he's actually nervous about losing that race and believes this, then, you know, the Democrats really are in a good position to push. Now, you know, I don't know what they can get out of this. I don't know if that magic number is inviolable or whether or not they could actually push that in some way or find some other method.
David Dayen, you know, has some suggestions on that front, things like make the unemployment insurance payments not taxable, or, you know, these type of things where you can not necessarily have any direct spending, but, you know, it's a tax cut. How can you argue against that if you're a Republican? These type of things. Maybe, you know, it would be nice if they were automatic stabilizer. It would be nice if it was longer in terms of time. But there are other things you can do to alleviate some of the pressure that doesn't feel like you're spending money for whatever reason. You know, there's a problem there with that. They're trying to get that, like, they're trying to get a billion dollar fund with FEMA to help cities and states to sort of backdoor that, because we have real problem with that. But I don't know how well that's going. That's probably why, frankly, I mean, they're still trying to go through the weekend. But I mean, they have leverage, and it's hard to know exactly what that leverage, you know, how much that leverage is, right? I mean, because obviously the leverage goes away January 6th. Because the election's over. Maybe it goes away January 3rd. I don't know. You know, like, at what point does it become the ship has sailed, as it were, for those candidates? And I don't know.
I don't know either. And I probably nobody knows. I mean, that election in Georgia is, you know, I mean, it's such a crapshoot for both parties. I mean, who knows? And, you know, they're working hard on suppressing votes down there. It's one of the things, most irritating things to me about this, is that, you know, we valorize these guys like Raffensperger, the Secretary of State, because he stood up to Trump. But, you know, he went right back to doing suppression and limiting the early voting places and all that stuff. So, you know, you have to be real careful with these people. I mean, there are some who I think have made a true change of heart. But for the most part, you know, these guys are going to use this, even, you know, especially maybe if they're the heroes who stood up to Trump, then they're going to be the ones with the credibility to do more vote suppression. So
right.
I don't know what's going to happen down there. And, you know, also remember, we're in the middle of a pandemic, and, you know, there it's very hard to know
who's going to show up and vote.
Yeah, who's going to show up, and, you know, how that's going to go, and whether or not that's going to extend the pandemic. I mean, you know, there are a lot of variables here that are unusual, even in this unusual situation of a runoff like this, of having two races at the same time in Georgia. This is, you know, it's a very, you know, unusual situation. But in any case, I do think that this is one of those times where, if, you know, they're clever in their negotiations, they can probably eke out more. And they could even, you know, in the case of that, you know, not taxing the unemployment insurance, they could, you know, let the Republicans be the, you know, take credit for the tax cut if they wanted to, you know, say, well, you know, that was our thing. We got in there. We didn't want them taxed. But, of course, they don't want to do that, because the only people they don't want to tax are rich people. And
right.
People on unemployment insurance aren't rich. So, but that would, you know, that's another talking point for Warnock and Ossoff if they nixed something like that. I mean, they could use some of these things. And here's another thing. You know, I mean, we've got the Republicans now. I just read this morning that they want to include language that would terminate the Fed's emergency lending program at the end of the year, and that just cuts off a huge amount of the Biden administration's flexibility if that thing is cut off, and then trying to get something like it passed again. It is a real poison pill, and they're not going to go with it. I don't think the Democrats can possibly do that, but it just shows you that, you know, these Republicans, for whatever they're trying to do, whatever they need to do for their to maintain control of the Senate, you know, you can only imagine the kind of things that they're, you know, pushing behind the scenes, because they really don't believe in this relief program at all. I mean, they don't believe in it. They don't want to do it. They don't care if people are suffering. They do not care. In fact, I think they want them to. You know, I mean, now that Biden is coming in, they want people suffering so that they can blame it, you know, blame it on the Democrats. They're looking forward to that. So, you know, this is a very, very, when you're dealing with a party, a nihilistic, kind of rogue political party, which is what the Republicans have been, it just makes things so difficult, because we have enough problems just with normal, partisan, intra-partisan, differences to try and get anything decent done. And now you've got these people who are just ready to throw sand in the gears whenever they get a chance. So, I mean, I hope everybody's girding themselves for a tough time going forward, because it's not going to be easy either with the centrist Democrats, the Republicans, it's just going to be very, very tough.
It's going to be very tough. And in this situation, I don't know. I mean, I've been quite explicit about, I believe, the series of failures in terms of legislative maneuvers and messaging and timing, as performed by Nancy Pelosi. I mean, she told everybody in April, assured everybody, we're going to get billions of dollars for cities and states, and that clearly is not going to happen. And we're 8 months into it, and the implications are going to be huge. But I don't know I don't have a sense of how far you put, at what point you're overplaying your hand in terms of the leverage they have now. Because, like I say, they don't have any leverage on January 6th. We know that for sure. And then January 5, 4, 3, 2, 1. How much leverage do the Democrats have? I would imagine diminishing in some respects. So you get the best you can at this point because, and like I say, you're limited by the bad decisions that happened in the past. And you go forward. But I agree with you. The Republicans, they don't care. This is, if it wasn't for Ossoff and Warnock, they wouldn't be doing anything. And frankly, these outside expenditure groups, they should be doubling up on this stuff so that even if there is a deal, you have this resonating in the minds of voters that it was the Republicans who were standing in the way from it and the way of it. And let's just, since we've touched on that, we got a minute or two, a couple minutes left here. There was leaked audio last week where Joe Biden said, my progressive friends want me to take some executive actions and I'm not going to do that because it's unconstitutional. I mean, that's a bad sign to me that Joe Biden's already saying, apparently on record is saying 6 or 7 months after my presidency starts, that's when we're going to start to see these Republicans come around. I am very worried about that perspective because I think it's completely wrong.
It is totally wrong. I mean, I've been worried about it since, Joe Biden started running.
Right.
And, you and I have talked about this a lot over the last, year and a half as the campaigns were going on, was that, he seems to really believe this, that he has some kind of very special relationship with Republicans, and maybe he did 25 years ago, although even then they were crazy, but they're much crazier now. But it's not true. I mean, number one, there aren't that many that are still in Congress that were there when he was there.
Right.
I mean, he's been out for a long time. So whatever personal relationships he has, now, he, does not have a good relationship with Mitch McConnell. That's ridiculous. Mitch McConnell is a robot. He is not. He does not care whether or not he and, you know, and Joe Biden have a history or whatever. It's just not. Look at what happened with Lindsey Graham.
Right.
They were actually close. I mean, look at what happened to that. So it's a real delusion on his part. I'm not sure whether or not, you know, he believes it to the point where he will, you know, hang on to it beyond all, you know, evidence that shows that it's not working. I don't know. And I don't know whether or not people around him, I don't think Ron Klain believes that. I mean, nothing I've seen from him says that he thinks they can work with Republicans. And most of the people around him, even the ones that are sort of predictably centrist types, I don't think they're quite that deluded. So, I don't know what to make of this other than my feeling is that exactly what you say. It's a bad sign, and we are going to have to keep our eyes on this.
Right.
And this is not, I mean, I always worried about it. I got it from an electoral standpoint. You know, you want to tell the, hey, I'm everybody's president. I believe in unity. I'm restoring the soul of the nation, blah, blah, blah. I get it. You know, he was trying to win an election. But did he believe that? Yeah, I think he did. And
yeah.
I think that it is not a good thing. We don't have time to waste on this, right? I mean, sitting there, you know, trying to negotiate with Mitch McConnell on something that Mitch McConnell is not going to in any way cooperate is a big problem. So, I mean, at this point, I'm just hoping that maybe the Democrats can pull it off in Georgia. If that happens, we're in better shape. It's not perfect. We still have Joe Manchin to deal with. We've got Kyrsten Sinema. We've got a bunch of people who
Mark
are going
Kelly,
to be.
Yeah, it's going to be. Yeah, it's
part of the centrist, you know, the gang of however many in the middle there with Mitt Romney and who knows who, Ben Sasse maybe. And they'll be trying to run things. But still, it's better than Mitch McConnell. So, you know, I'll take it. But nonetheless, it's going to be a problem. And you know, we're going to have to push from outside to the extent we can to ensure. That's why I have no problem with any of the stuff that's going on with the left right now. You know, people are saying, oh, they need, you know, they're being too picky and they're causing too much dissension and blah, blah, blah. If we ever needed it, it's now. There has to be a squeaky wheel because we can't trust Joe Biden to understand what he's up against. We just can't.
No, absolutely not. 100% not. And, you know, and frankly, you and I have talked about this for months. Joe Biden is my second favorite type of politician,
right,
in that he's a cipher. And we have seen, I think, over the course of his building of his cabinet, which, you know, some people say is in many respects incohesive. I think it is incohesive, but it is, I mean, I don't know. The only thing I can make an analogy is that, you know, the best time when I was back in show business, you know, I want to pitch a show and sell it is usually when the network is, you know, pretty, obviously I'd love to go to a network that wants to feature Sam Cedar material, but the second best opportunity is a network that's completely in upheaval and doesn't know exactly what they want. And then you
right,
can come
right,
in
right.
and sell it to them. And there's a little bit of that with the Joe Biden administration
yeah,
so
I think
far.
So.
Deb Haaland, I think, has just been named
yep.
Interior Secretary. That's a big win. There was a big win on the Energy Department. I think in terms of like seriousness when it comes to climate change, we had McCarthy there as well, and we had the Jennifer Granholm, the former governor of Michigan. Both, you know, from a climate change perspective, people are very excited. We have not seen a Rahm Emanuel type figure, and that's a good thing. So, you know, I would say the cabinet's, you know, sort of mixed in some respects, but, certainly I think the Biden administration is showing that they can be pushed
yeah.
in certain directions. And
they're hearing
that's a good
thing. which I didn't necessarily expect. I mean, they're right. hearing it. They're hearing that when they put out their trial balloons, they're hearing the, which everybody does. I mean, all presidents, in these transitions, they throw out a trial balloon and wait to see what happens. But often they don't hear what people are actually saying. Yep. And I actually feel like they are and are attempting to be at least somewhat responsive to it, you know, finding, they're creatively trying to find ways to be responsive to it. And that is a good sign. You know, that says something. So,
well, Heather, next week will be our last show of 2020. If we spend the whole show just saying thank you for ending this year, that would be enough. But we probably want to add some other things to it.
Absolutely, yeah. Well, we can sing it, we can, you know, we can chant it, we can do whatever. But God help us. I am so glad to see this, you know, this period over, and maybe the pandemic is on its way out as well. We have this awful period right now, but sometime maybe in the next 6 months we can start to feel a little bit normal again.
Hope springs eternal, indeed. And Heather, as always, thank you so much for your time today. We'll talk to you next week.
Okay, talk to you later.
Bye-bye.
Hey everyone, I am here with Matthew Clare, who is an assistant professor of sociology at Stanford University and the author of Privilege and Punishment: How Race and Class Matter in Criminal Court. And he also wrote this fascinating piece in The Nation, one of the best magazines in the country, but I'm sure you know that already, about how we end up with, or how we have ended up with, our current public defender system, which, as you laid out in the piece, has a rich history. But I'd love to talk to you about that. How are you, Matthew?
I'm doing all right. Doing as well as all of us are, I suppose, in this moment. Good to see you.
Exactly. Good to see you, too. So let's talk about your piece, because what I think is so fascinating is how you connected the distrust of public defenders and the fact that a lot of people don't have warm and cozy feelings about the public defense system to a larger lack of faith in our criminal justice system and the prosecutorial system, how it's kind of all a part of a greater whole. But the origins of the public defender system are fascinating, too. So just talk about the overarching theme of it being connected to the criminal justice system as a whole.
Yeah, I mean, so, you know, I'll say, you know, many defendants, we sort of hear often this term of the public pretender, right, from people who are in the system and they're poor and they rely on public defenders for their representation. And sort of that indicates, you know, that maybe these people who are supposed to be on my side and are representing me are actually pretending and are really colluding with government or DAs and, you know, really think I'm guilty. And that indictment from defendants is really not an indictment necessarily of the specific lawyer or even really of sort of really believing that the lawyer is not on their side. It's more an indictment of the broader system and realizing the lack of resources that public defenders have, and also realizing that so much of the criminal court process and so much of them going through the process is about mitigating legal outcomes and just minimizing the impact of the process, rather than actually helping people thrive and flourish as humans and even not allowing for accountability for people that they may have harmed and recognize that they have harmed. And so people who go through the system as defendants are indicting not just their public defenders, but really the broader system as a whole.
Certainly. So let's talk then about the origins of public defenders. So it seems like in your piece, you wrote about how in the 1890s, progressive thinkers started talking about the idea of a public defender, and even more radical progressives or more forward-thinking progressives brought up this idea that would be seen as radical today, but I think is so fascinating, that everybody should be forced to use a public defender, almost eliminating the need for private law. I mean, I'm sure for corporate law, mergers and acquisitions, things like that, I guess, yeah, there is a place for that. But can you talk about those initial discussions and what they evolved to?
Yeah. So I just want to sort of first say that this piece is very much emerging from my reading of and review of Sarah Mayu's work and her book Free Justice, which is a fantastic book that I think everyone should pick up to really get a deep sense of the history of the emergence of the public defender. And for me, as someone who studies the contemporary way public defender systems work, it was a really profound insight that I was not aware of before reading the book. But so, yeah, in the progressive era, some people who were starting to think about maybe we should have, instead of this sort of patchwork system of voluntary lawyers who jump in and fly in, some who ask for ridiculous things, like first extort people, but then also ask for sexual favors in return for just defending people. It was a really corrupt system.
Just quickly touching on that, mm-hmm. that was a jarring part of your piece and what you wrote about. The fact that Black defendants specifically back in those times, they were either lynched, victims of mob violence, or mm-hmm. tortured into giving guilty pleas, which you talked about. But if they did have a lawyer, they were often extorted for a lot of money, or sexual favors were asked for in return for their services.
Right. And so part of the hope was, you know, if we establish this public defender system, you know, where the government is providing attorneys and also could have some sort of check on, right, how attorneys are operating and making sure that they're abiding by reputable practices, then hopefully we could provide justice, not just to poor people and some people. I will say, you know, in reading the book, it seemed like these are people who are really on the sort of the radical side of thinking about public defenders. They were really, some of them were advocating for the idea that we should give public defenders to rich people too, because then there would be less of an incentive, right, of private attorneys coming in and sort of doing good things for their paying clients and then not so great things for their not paid clients. And so if everyone goes through the system having a public attorney, then they're getting literally the same kind of justice structurally.
Yeah, that was fascinating. And I am curious too about, the case, I wrote it down here. Gideon versus Wainwright. So that was mm-hmm. when it was first established that it was required for states to have public defenders. But before that, you talked about how they were really rare in the 1950s. How did we get from that point when they were rare and kind of the beginning of an idea, to the point where the Supreme Court actually ruled that states had to, appoint public defenders?
Yeah. So one of the fascinating things about Sarah Mayhew's book in particular, and also other work that's looked at the history of public defense, but I think Mayhew's book in particular really drives this point home, is the idea that we cannot understand the emergence of public defenders and just indigent defense provision more generally outside of the public defender system in particular without understanding concerns among liberals. So this could be sort of elites, really Republicans and Democrats at the time, who sort of consider themselves moderate, sort of investing in liberal democracy, right? And we're worried about increasing fears of communism in the United States. And we're using and thought that maybe if we provide public defense, this is sort of our commitment to democratic ideals and values. And it's also sort of the symbolic commitment of, hey, look, you know, in, you know, the Soviet Union, you see and hear these stories of these show trials and people don't get real justice. But in the United States, we care a lot about providing real justice. We give even the poorest among us, right, paid attorneys. And so it was really sort of we could read it sort of with negative intention, but some people actually did want to provide public defense, right? But it was a story of, it led to an opening where people who were much more on the progressive side, but then also moderates, could sort of get on the same page of, oh, actually providing indigent defense could be something that could allow us to commit to democratic, liberal democratic values, and also for progressives, help poor people.
So progressives kind of saw an opening in the American exceptionalistic view, or exceptionalists, I should say, view that we're so much better than other countries. We're so much better than the Soviet Union. We actually care about justice. So that is really interesting, and it shows how many of our norms that we take for granted in the current times sprung out of the Red Scare and just weird moments in history like that create institutions. So you open your piece talking about George Floyd, obviously one of the most important moments in racial justice history here, and how he, in 2004, was convicted of a drug-related offense, but it seems like the cop or the prosecutor, I think it was the cop, right, who arrested him, had a really shady past. Can mm-hmm. you connect that to your piece and also just talk about that story, bring it home to kind of the watershed moment of the Black Lives Matter movement this year?
Yeah, definitely. It was the detective in Houston who, the public defender's office down in Houston is really working on trying to figure out all of the cases that this detective was fabricating evidence in. And George Floyd's case was one of those possible cases. And so for me, I opened the piece that way because I think what's happening right now in the Black Lives Movement and the radical potential that we have to really shift the way we do a lot of things in this country that will have implications for policing and prisons. But beyond that, sort of the way we're dealing with the pandemic and just rebuilding a robust welfare state that actually never existed in the United States. And I think that this potential moment is really important to also recognize the unique contribution that the court process in particular has to racialized forms of social control. And so I open talking about George Floyd because I really wanted people to think, of course, I know about George Floyd because of those 8 minutes where his neck was under the knee of a white police officer and his death. But also in his life, he was controlled by the court process, carceral tools and techniques and systems that are broader than just that police incident. And so in talking about sort of the fabrication of evidence, the prosecutor's office is not checking, right? And really sort of making sure that they're doing their due diligence to make sure that frivolous charges aren't being brought or that police who are known to, you know, fabricate evidence aren't allowed to testify. That's really a problem. And that's a problem of the court system. And so that's sort of why I opened up the piece talking about, let's think about the life that George Floyd led and how even in that life, he was being controlled by punitive systems of social control.
Well, I love that because it's a more holistic view. And I think you took a more holistic view in your piece where you kind of bookended talking about prosecution, the criminal justice system, and then, you know, talked a lot about public defenders and their role. But I want to, you know, max out a little bit and talk about prosecution and how you made this great point about how punitive measures for police who murder or brutalize Black people most frequently, how that's almost a part of the same wheel, the same messed up system that we're dealing with. And I never thought of it that way, but it is an example of thinking small. And I wanted to know if you could expand upon that.
Yeah. So, you know, I think the Black Lives Movement has been really wonderful, especially sort of the more progressive side increasingly that has moved to the center and thinking about what does abolition mean, right? What do we mean by we need to get rid of these punitive systems of social control? And part of that means that we need to have a more humane way of thinking about accountability. And so this applies not just to the least of us, so Black people, Latinx people, poor people who are routinely pulled into the system, but also thinking about even how do we deal with other types of harm, state-sanctioned harm through the guise of an individual-level police officer, right? How do we think about accountability there? Do we want to prosecute that police officer, or is that only legitimating a system that exists and that we know on average and on net is more coercive toward marginalized communities? And so thinking about how alternative ways of holding those people accountable as well when they commit harm, not involving policing, prosecuting, and also incarcerating police officers is part of that conversation. And it's a hard conversation to have, and not everyone's there. You know, oftentimes after these events, the first thing is to demand justice through the courts, you know, prosecute the police officer. But first of all, that rarely ever results. First, the prosecution rarely happens, but then,
prosecutors are largely friends with, or oftentimes in bed right. with the police because they're
exactly.
one and the same.
Right, exactly. And so there's this institutional dynamic and, you know, Nicole Gonzalez Van Cleve's work talks a lot about this institutional dynamic where police and prosecutors really are, as you said, sort of one and the same, if you will, and they depend on each other. But so rarely does the prosecution happen. But then even after that, rarely is there conviction. And that's because of this sort of court created scaffolding in law. Of dealing with and thinking about how the Fourth Amendment allows police officers to engage in many forms of things that the average citizen would consider abuse or violations of search and seizure.
So how do we get the public there? I know this may not be, you know, your area, but to me, I understand the calls for justice, and I understand the anger when a police officer gets off. You know, Tamir Rice is the example that sticks out in my mind forever as the most gut-wrenching example of this injustice. But how do you change that conversation? And I know it could be decades until people are okay with, like, okay, we need to even the, you know, your principles aren't tested when it's an easy case, kind of what you were saying. They're tested when it's a hard case, like an abusive police officer. So how do you change the framework of the conversation to get to that point?
Right. I think part of it is a moral argument about how we want to treat people. But I think another part of it is a really just sort of strategic material argument of, hey, at the end of the day, is pulling that police officer through the system and then incarcerating them for a short period of time, what are they going to be like when they come out of that, right? What's someone who harms or murders going to be like after they come out of being incarcerated for a period of time? Are they going to be better people? Are they going to be flourishing people? Are they going to contribute to our society? Probably not. They won't have recognized the harm that they caused. They won't have gone through the methods of accountability and repair and restoration that's needed to bring them back into the community, because our process is so adversarial. It's just not set up to make people restore the harm that they caused in the community. And so I think that's part of the argument, is thinking, okay, is this sort of form of like, we got this police officer and we're pulling them into the system and we're prosecuting as you know, many in our communities are being prosecuted, which we're arguing is harmful, right? Is that form of harm actually going to make up for the loss of life that this police officer took from us? It's not. It's not going to lead to closure and restoration. And so thinking of alternative methods. And so there's a lot of work in the restorative justice space, Daniel Sered's work, and so many other people, Fannie Davis and others who are working in this restorative justice space that really have pushed the imagination there with what we can do to produce accountability and restore communities.
Matthew Clare, assistant professor of sociology at Stanford University and the author of Privilege and Punishment, How Race and Class Matter in Criminal Court, and of course the author of This Nation piece, How Did We End Up With Our Current Public Defender System? So I encourage everyone to read it. We'll link to it. Thank you so much, Matthew, for your time.
Thanks for having me.
That's it for another week of Ring of Fire. Are you still subscribed to our free show? Well, head over to rofpodcast.com. Do us both a favor. Support the show by becoming a member. Follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. You can watch our videos on YouTube. You can go to ringoffireradio.com to find out more. And check out my daily show, The Majority Report. Head over to majority.fm daily for a live stream at noon. I'm joined by Emma on all those programs. You can check out in-depth interviews and the biggest news stories of the day. I'm Sam Cedar. This has been Ring of Fire.